Welcome to Behind the Case, an ECG Case Report Journal podcast. This is Fuad Jaber. I'm a second year GI fellow at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and I'm an associate editor at ECG Case Report Journal. In this episode, we are diving into a fascinating and rare case of cystic artery pseudoaneurysm as a complication of acute cholecystitis presenting as gastric outlet obstruction. It's an unusual complication of acute cholecystitis that underscores the importance of multidisciplinary care between gastroenterology, interventional radiology, and surgery. Joining me today are Dr. Anil John. He is an advanced endoscopist at Hamad Medical Corporation at Qatar, and he is the lead author for this case report. Also today joining me, Dr. Tara Kahanian, as invited guest expert. She is advanced endoscopist and assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Thank you both for joining us today. I'm going to start with Dr. John. The first question, can you please, Dr. John, walk us through the thought process for this case from the initial presentation of acute cholecystitis to eventual diagnosis of cystic artery pseudoaneurysm?
Thank you, Dr. Fuad. Basically, I'm glad that this case was chosen as a very interesting and fascinating case by the ECG. So basically, this was a 42-year-old Filipino expatriate who was working in Qatar. He presented to no significant comorbidities except well-controlled diabetes and hypertension. So he presented to us, to the emergency, with a typical features of an acute cholecystitis, a positive Murphy sign, features of systemic inflammation with elevated fever, elevated CRP, marked leukocytosis, and imaging consistent with calculus cholecystitis, with a positive sonological Murphy and clinical Murphy sign. So there's no doubt about a diagnosis of cholecystitis, but the LFTs were a bit abnormal, but there's no organ dysfunction. So we considered him to have moderately severe acute cholecystitis, admitted him on antibiotics, got the surgeon to see for an early lab coli. That's a protocol initial presentation. We could do a lab coli in an otherwise well patient. But the surgeons felt that there's probably an element of cholangitis also with CBD stones, because the CBD was slightly dilated and the LFTs were abnormal. Bilirubin was high, ALT and AST was also slightly high in the hundreds. So in view of the suspicion of cholangitis, intermediate possibility of CBD stones, we proceeded with an endoscopic ultrasound. And that showed a dilated CBD with a lot of sludge. So we thought we will give him the benefit of the doubt of cholangitis and proceeded with bitocheoids for almost, suspected cholangitis. So we proceeded with an ERCP, spintrotomy, and a biliary stenting. And management of cholecystitis with antibiotics, fluids, and symptomatic measures, and the patient improved clinically. So this is the first week story. So the patient improved. And counts started coming down, inflammatory markers coming down. So we discharged him off home. A week after that, he comes back again to the emergency, complaining of persistent vomiting, not able to really eat anything. And orally, he was not taking anything, persistently vomiting, again with abdominal pain, in the, mostly in the right upper quadrant, and again, fever persisting. So that's a time when he was readmitted. So because of this, we thought it's some sort of a there's no GI bleed at all, no malignant, no hematemesis. So we really thought this is some complication of acute cholecystitis, maybe an empyema, maybe a perforated gallbladder, because he was in pain as well. So we proceeded with a CT imaging. So CT imaging, to our surprise, showed that the duodenum was compressed, D1 and D2, there was stasis in the stomach, and also there is some hyperdense material in the paraduodenal area, starting from the GB fossa and sort of compressing the duodenum, and features of gangrenous inflammation of the gallbladder, which is probably worse than it was before. So that was a picture with which the patient came in. So because of this gastric stasis and the duodenal compression, the first thing we did was to have a quick OGD and see. upper endoscopy. And the upper endoscopy showed gastric stasis. We are not able to go beyond the pylorus. The duodenum is completely compressed. I have the pictures of that in the article. So that confirmed a gastric level obstruction. At the same time, the gallbladder was looking bad, gangrenous inflammation, and we knew that it needed some of a drainage. Lap coli was out of question because of this, you know, all these complications, duodenal, the paradrenal hematoma, and endoscopic drainage of the GB was impossible because the duodenum is obstructed. And so we proceeded with a percutaneous cholecystostomy, and antibiotics was continued. Okay. But surprising thing is, around this time, we noticed that without any overt GI bleeding, he's dropping his hemoglobin. We discharged him with a hemoglobin of 14, and now it was 8. And no hematemesis, no overt GI bleeding. So that's when we thought, with this paradural hematoma also, we got a surgical opinion. They felt, of course, they said, you did an ERCP, and after the ERCP, you probably had a post-penetratomy bleed, and that is what causing the duodenal hematoma. So anyway, because it was a hematoma and bled, we thought we would proceed with the CT angio. So CT angio showed that this was definitely bled only. It is a hematoma in the paradrenal area, and the contrast leak was seen right in the middle of the hematoma. And you can see in one of the pictures, it is a branch of the right hepatic artery which is leaking in the middle of the hematoma. So that brought in the suspicion of an aneurysm or some other reason why you have leak in the middle of the hematoma. So we proceeded with a selective catheter angiogram immediately. And the common hepatic was actually arising. It was aberrant from the superior mesenteric artery. They cannulated the IR cannulated the common hepatic, entered the right hepatic, and they found the aneurysm was from the branch of the right hepatic in the cystic artery. So, and there was a definite leak demonstrated, and the patient underwent coil embolization, and the leak was sealed. After that, we observed him in the hospital. His hemoglobin sort of stabilized. He started improving over a period, over a week clinically, and the cholecystostomy tube was removed. And we again contacted the surgeons. They said he is beyond the window for a cholecystectomy almost 2-3 weeks. So we will do an elective cholecystectomy. And he was discharged from hospital. So this is how the whole episode progressed. You know, initially after the ERCP, when you have a hematoma there, one really thinks in terms of a post-ERCP complication and a hematoma. That's what we initially thought. But to a surprise, it turned out to be something else, completely different.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. John. That was very comprehensive. Just a follow-up question. What was the thought process and rationale for choosing conservative management during the patient first presentation for acute cholecystitis? Was there any plan for like delayed cholecystectomy on the first presentation?
Actually, on the first presentation, we actually referred him to the surgeons for a lap coli. But the surgeons got back to us saying that, you know, there is probably an ongoing, his patient is a bit sick, probably is an ongoing cholangitis, dilated CVD, abnormal LFTs, he is a jaundiced, and LFTs are high, so there is possibility of a CVD stone. So we classified it as an intermediate possibility, and, you know, we did an EUS, a lot of sludge, so we did an ERCP. So by the time, you know, things sort of got delayed a bit, they said it's out of the window of early cholecystectomy, and they asked us to call him back, remove the stent, clear the CBD, and a lap coli after 6 weeks. That was a plan. But when he came, returned with all these complications, you know, lap coli was out of question. You had a paradrenal hematoma, surgery would have been very difficult, and you know, that is how everything got delayed. But ideally, I agree with you. Initially, if it was possible, an early lap coli would have probably been the optimal management for this patient. But it didn't really work out that way.
Yeah, makes sense. Dr. John, looking back in the hindsight, is there anything you might have done differently during the initial evaluation or management for this patient?
Looking back, as I told you, you know, if we could have got his lap coli and early, you know, in the initial three days of waiting. Yeah. I don't know whether we would have prevented all these complications, but we took another track and, you know, into possibility of cholangitis and things were delayed. So looking back, but there was justification to do an ERCP also because the liver functions were abnormal and the patient was jaundiced and the CVD was dilated and the EUS chewed a lot of sludge. So we thought we need to have a sphincterotomy and stenting. So that's how matters progressed, you know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he had all the indications for getting ERCP first. So switching to Dr. Kahanian, from your experience, what are the imaging hallmarks that can help us distinguish between like a pseudoaneurysm from other like gallbladder related collections like abscess or hematoma after ERCP? Yeah.
First of all, thank you so much, Dr. Jauber, for this invitation. That's an actually excellent question. So on contrast-enhanced CT scan, the key distinguishing feature for a pseudoaneurysm that we see is a focal contrast blush, that bright spot indicating active arterial flow, as opposed to the static low attenuation appearance that we see with abscess and biloma. A biloma usually appears as a smooth, non-enhancing fluid collection, and abscesses tends to have a thicker, irregular enhancing wall. Sometimes they can also see gas inside or internal debris that is more clue. A pseudoaneurysm, by contrast, shows high attenuation, around 60 to 90 Hounsfield units, comparing to less than 10 to 24 abscesses and bilomas, and lights up during the arterial phase because blood is actually flowing within the sac, usually connected to the cystic or the hepatic artery. Right hepatic artery. In this patient, actually the arterial phase blush and the dense subhepatic collection compressing the duodenum were classic for a vascular lesion. And when available, I would say that Doppler ultrasound or contrast enhanced EUS can also be helpful by showing tubulin intraluminal flow, a pattern that is very unusual to be seen in the setting of abscesses and biloma.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was very helpful for us. Back to Dr. John. For this presentation, like gastric outlet obstruction due to like cystic artery pseudoaneurysm, it's like extremely rare. What lessons can we as a clinician take away to help recognize such atypical presentations early on?
You know, this was a surprise for us also. You know, we really never considered gastric outlet obstruction to be the cause for vomiting. We thought this is probably some sort of a complication of a bad cholecystitis, a perforated GB or an empyema or an abscess. So that is why we did the imaging, not suspecting gastric outlet obstruction. So that is a completely, surprising finding, the duodenum being compressed by a paradural hematoma. And that was a complete surprise to us. But the clinical presentation, going back and asking the patient, was his complaint this time was predominantly vomiting and inability to eat. Okay. Yeah. Unlike the first presentation, when he said it was a feature of fever, you know, abdominal pain. Here, the predominant symptom, when we look back, he said he's continuously vomiting. I'm not able to eat, whatever he eats, he brings it up after some time. So that was the picture we got from the patient. So I think, the imaging gave us a diagnosis, but looking back, I think clinically, talking to the patient, he would have probably told us this is, but we never really suspected it upfront. That is a fact. Imaging will give you surprises as against your clinical thinking process altogether.
Yeah, thank you so much for pointing that out. I think it's important that the second presentation was kind of like different in the symptoms, like being, vomiting and poor BO intake, that can like different than the fever and abdominal pain that he had for the first presentation. So I think, it's quite surprising, but I think, taking also like a good history on might help narrow down our differentials. Back to Dr. Kahanian, how can radiologists and gastroenterologists as a team collaborate effectively to identify subtle vascular findings on CT or endoscopic ultrasound, especially in such very complex and complicated hepatobiliary cases?
That's actually such a very important question, because these subtle vascular findings are very easy to miss unless we look for them in the imaging in combination of multimodality imaging. From a gastroenterology standpoint, we're often first to see these patients are having pain or having acute issues. Maybe we find any findings during a routine ultrasound or EUS. We may notice a pericholecystic mass or a small pulsatile signal that doesn't quite fit the abscess or biloma or inflammation scenario. That's exactly where we would seek early input from a radiology. And that's a very critical step. On the flip side, radiologists can really help by flagging any contrast blush, unusual arterial enhancement, or evolving hematoma pattern that may suggest a pseudoaneurysm instead of infection. I think the best outcome for all of our patients comes when we review these cases side by side from whatever modality endoscopically we have with the radiologist, because only in that collaborative interpretation can make the difference between a delayed diagnosis and a life-saving intervention. I think this case is a perfect example of how real-time collaboration between GI, radiology, interventional radiology transforms a very rare and high-risk finding into a coordinated, successful management plan.
That's great. Thank you so much. Now, with Dr. Kahane and Dr. John, both of you are like advanced vascularists, so we want to get more experience from you. So the next couple of questions are for you both. So I want to hear from you both. The first question is, how would you approach similar case in a resource-limited settings where interventional radiology is not really available? We can start with Dr. John first.
I think looking back, the only substitute for interventional radiology in such a situation would have been open surgery with evacuation of the hematoma and ligation of the aneurysm. But here, IER really helped us avoid a major invasive surgery with a very minimally invasive targeted approach. So I think looking forward, you know, these minimally invasive targeted approaches should be the way to go. And surgery should always be available as a backup or as a second choice. Because this patient, you know, had the patient had an open colli evacuation of the, you know, hematoma and ligation of the aneurysm, all this, it was done, patient would have had a long postoperative course. And, you know, this patient was relatively young, but, you know, in a patient with comorbidities would have been disastrous. So I think there is no substitute for IR in such a situation, IR and endoscopy combination. We need to have, such multidisciplinary combined approach, at least in some focal areas in each geography, so that patients can be referred to such centers. And I think there's no substitute for, in this time and age, for a minimally invasive targeted approach. When the technology is available, I think it should be available to one and all. And surgery should definitely be the second line or the backup option.
Yeah, I agree. Such cases are really very complicated, and we need such like a good collaboration between all the teams. Dr. Kahanian, what do you think about this?
I totally agree with Dr. John's statements. Of course, in this type of situation, the most important thing is stabilizing the patient, like resuscitation, blood transfusion, hemodynamic resuscitation. That's very important. I guess if I agree, if their IR is not available, it should be surgical ligation of the cystic artery or open cholecystectomy with vascular control. That would be the best next option. I would say that it is a multidisciplinary triage that Dr. John mentioned, and IR would benefit these patients really the most.
I think we all agree that, you know, and this comes to our final question. I think both of you, Dr. John, Dr. Kahanian, touched base on this. But any final word or like emphasis of multidisciplinary collaboration between GI, IR, and surgery in managing those cases from your experience and from your fitting in the hospital? Any final words on this kind of like important topic from you both? Can I start with Dr. John as well?
Actually, what we learned as a team, you know, in this patient, it was truly a learning experience for us. What we learned is, you know, in the setting of acute cholecystitis, severe acute cholecystitis, if the patient has an unexplained drop in his hematocrit or hemoglobin, with or without over GI bleed, you know, one has to keep the possibility of a pseudoaneurysm in mind. because in this case, there was no overt GI bleeding, but it can very often happen that, you know, a pseudoaneurysm can erode into the cystic duct and the patient can present with hemophilia and overt GI bleeding. So this does not happen here, but I think that is more, reviewing literature, that is more of a more common presentation with GI bleed and hemophilia. So that was not the picture, but in the context of severe acute cholecystitis, an unexplained drop in his hematocrit, always look for a pseudoaneurysm or its complications. Acute cholecystitis is a relatively common condition, but pseudoaneurysm related to that is much, much rare. But when you have a drop in hematocrit in this clinical setting, I think one should have your thinking process going towards a possibility of a pseudoaneurysm or its complications. That's the most important learning point we learned from this case. And of course, I mean, the second thing is the importance of multidisciplinary care, you know, the IR, the surgeons, and the gastroenterologists together managing and giving the best outcome for our patients with a minimally invasive approach. I think that should be the way to go in this time and age.
That's very important, actually. And, you know, just for us as a clinician to keep in mind, you know, dropping in hemoglobin, even without, you know, overt GI bleeding, we should keep high suspicion for something, you know, localized like hematoma. Back to Dr. Kahanian, any final words on this case or any final emphasis on importance of multidisciplinary collaboration for such cases?
I think actually that I agree totally with you and Dr. John. I would say that this case really highlights how multidisciplinary collaboration for management of these cases is not is an optional issue. It's essential because when we, all the teams, we early on talk together, we looked at the images together, we make a decision together, everything moves faster, safer, patients have better outcome. So I think actually this is the only lesson we can take from this case.
Thank you so much for you both, Dr. John and Dr. Kahanian, for sharing your insights and your experience on this very atypical and important case. Thank you for your time as well, and thank you for your expertise. And hopefully we'll see you on another episode. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fuad, for anchoring this session, choosing our case. And thank you, Dr. Kahanian, for being here as an expert in this.
Thank you, Dr. John, and thank you, Dr. Jabber. Thank you.
Thank you so much.